had the good fortune to talk to William Connacher, an amazing dialect coach who helped for the movie Oppenheimer. Listen to how a dialect coach goes about helping an actor with an idiolect, which is a specific person's accent, their unique way of speaking. Today you get to hear William Connacher talk about the Mid-Atlantic accent, which you might not even know existed, and how the real J. Robert Oppenheimer spoke. Plus, what it's like to work with an actor preparing for a role with so many years of coaching under his belt. I'm Bianca, your personal American accent coach, and I'm here to help you master an American accent in English because your voice is your choice when it comes to how you sound. I try to release a podcast episode every 2 weeks, and so you should really subscribe to whatever podcast platform you use so that you don't miss the newest episode. And by the way, if you want to see the full video of the episode, it's available at Accent Coach Bianca on YouTube. Now, let's get on with the show. Dialect coaching is what you do. You work with people on screen and stage. Accent coaching is just more broad, right? For example, I work with people who are in business. I work with English teachers who want to get a better accent for themselves. I work with actors. I do voiceover stuff with people. So it's not just my job, but a dialect coach is just going to work with acting.
Yeah,
so
you explained it better.
Thank you so much for agreeing to come with me today and have this little discussion about idiolects and working on Oppenheimer. I'm really excited and fascinated about this. So tell us a little bit about you.
My name is William Connacher. I was an actor for about 2.5 minutes in the early 90s. And then I retrained as a voice teacher. Not really with a view to doing dialects, but not really with a view to doing anything except maybe a bit of breathing in drama schools. And then I got completely hooked on dialects when I was training. And then I went to teach at RADA for about 8 years. And then I met a lot of people and they sort of took me with them. And it's been nearly 30 years.
Oh, that is awesome. And you said when you got hooked on dialects, do you remember anything specifically about that time? Was it a specific movie? Was it an accent? Was it a specific actor that you were really drawn to?
It was more that I just didn't really know that that job existed. And then I thought, oh, that's okay. That's something very specific that I could do. And what I really liked about it was that, what I hadn't liked about acting was that you can't practice it in isolation. I've always said this, that if you're a ballet dancer or an artist or a juggler or anything, like, you have a skill set that you can practice on your own.
Mm-hmm.
That skill set, an actor's skill set, is very difficult to practice on your own. Yes, you can take voice class, you can take dance class, you can do movement, but it sort of really only exists as an interchange with the audience. And so it can be very isolating if you're not doing it all the time. What I loved for me personally as a sort of antidote to that time was that I was sufficiently nerdy about dialects and I would practice them all the time. And I read and read and read. This is, you know, there was internet, but there wasn't YouTube in the way that we use it now.
Mm-hmm.
I traveled and I interviewed people and I was just obsessed for years.
That's a really good point about the fact that it's got to be something interactive and dynamic, kind of like language. You have people who study a second language and their nose is in the book all the time and they don't have that opportunity or desire or the ability to speak with other people. And then the moment that they do, all that knowledge, it doesn't work. You have to communicate with people. It's a skill that if you learn it in tandem with somebody else, it's just so much better, so much richer in that way. And I think this is really exciting because this is your very first project ever, right?
What?
I'm totally kidding. Lowballing you there. Yeah, I want to get you to talk a little bit about some of the other projects you've worked on to see if people will recognize some of the names, some of the projects that you've worked on. So if you're not too shy, can you tell us some of the things that we might have seen that you've worked on before? Like some names like, I don't know, Cate Blanchett or other projects that you've worked on too. I think this is very interesting for our audience.
Wow. It's a lot to remember. So I did Bohemian Rhapsody with Rami Malek.
Mm-hmm.
I did Spencer with Kristen Stewart. Oh, this is probably my claim to fame. I've done 4 Princess Dianas.
Oh, very interesting.
Kristen on Spencer, but I also did 6 seasons of The Crown. So I did.
Wow.
Brennan, Elizabeth Debicki, but I had previously worked on the Naomi Watts movie, Diana. So 4 times of working with Princess Diana.
Amazing.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a lot. Like, it's 28 years. IMDb.
Yeah. Maybe I'm more like you. I'm very passionate about, like, the mechanics and the phonetics and the phonology. And specifically, I think this is the perfect time to bring this up, how we can talk about maybe accent in general, but then also what an idiolect is. For example, if you've worked four times on The Crown now, but this is a single person that lived in a specific time in a specific place, and you're really trying to nail that person. Can you talk a little bit about the difference that you feel between a general accent and an idiolect, a person-specific accent?
I resisted it for years, I have to say. I wasn't really interested in working on idiolects. And then when The Crown started, I had to do so many of them because there were so many characters and they were all real. And I learned very quickly that the trick to it is to not try and sound like the person in a way of listening and copying, but more analyzing. I like to watch the clips of them, if there's video, with no volume, so that I'm just looking at what they do with their mouth. And then if there isn't video, I'll listen to it. But instead of worrying about the sounds, I think about how it makes me feel. What does it make me want to do with my mouth when I listen to that sample? And so in that way, I think it's more like learning a dance or a set of steps than it is a series. It's more like learning a dance than it is like learning a song.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very stressful for people to just listen and copy.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can say to somebody, that person doesn't really open their mouth more than this, and if you can just get somebody to do that, I mean, if I just do that, it just changes the way that I sound. Or conversely, if they're the kind of person who has an enormous amount of range in their jaw, then that's definitely going to change the way they speak.
People don't think, they think accent, right? And they think of vowels or they think of pronunciation, but it's so much more than that. I think you're describing oral posture and also just personality and voice and how our voice is just an extension of all of that. Like our experiences, our past experiences, they just come through these words that we can't really grasp in the air, and they're there. And we try very badly to kind of notate it. We can write down the phonetics or we can clumsily explain it. Your voice is going to go up here a little more. But I think, like you said, inhabiting that and getting a feel for it is the most important or the most efficient way of sounding maybe like a person.
I think it's about putting your mechanics in the shape that the other person makes and then sounding like yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So then it feels more truthful, I think.
Yeah, because you're still the person who is doing that is still that person. We would want to have them inject at least a little bit of their own self into that to make it more authentic and not too copy-paste. Yeah, absolutely. So for me, it's really, really interesting because you've got, for example, if we're talking about idiolects, you've got maybe fictional idiolects. And when you close your eyes, you can imagine what Forrest Gump sounds like, right? You can imagine Ace Ventura, Jim Carrey doing Ace Ventura. You can imagine Robert De Niro being Vito Corleone. There is no way that you're going to confuse those things. And so we can have a fictional character.
They've become idiolects with hindsight. They're idiolects now because you can say that's a specific voice, but they weren't that's from the actor's imagination.
They're creating it, exactly. Yeah. They're creating a specific person. And I think what you're trying to do is almost recreate the, maybe not the specific voice, but the specific, how should I say, feel of the person so that they can like pull that out of the actor. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. And you mentioned already Rami Malek, right? Which is a person who was really alive. And we've got people who are still with us, like recently, not so recently, I guess, Jesse Eisenberg did Mark Zuckerberg, right? And you've got, for my favorite is like Joaquin Phoenix did Johnny Cash. And now what we're talking about now is how did you maybe approach that from your side? Just how can I prepare? How can I study J. Robert Oppenheimer's, let's say, the time in which he lived or the fact that he's a male and a scientist? What was your process, if you can talk a little bit about that, in preparing your own self to coach someone else to do this?
You know what? We are so fortunate to be living in this time where you can just go on YouTube and type in interview with Oppenheimer and there it is. I just listened to The Real Man a lot and found that he was, it's an accent that doesn't really exist anymore. He was a very educated in a very privileged way in New York, and he had an accent that to a British ear is more British than an American accent. Less R coloring and saying more T's, mentality. And he just had very, very particular words. You think, okay, that's an in. It's sort of more, it's more British sounding to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's really interesting to me. And you say, oh, I just watched some YouTube videos, but you have all this experience. So you watch these videos with a very different eye, I think, than most people would. Yeah. Oh, there's your cat. Look, we're having a cat party. Can we rewind a little bit and talk about those two things, the R's and the T's? You and I, we can just mention it. And I think we are both on the same page. But for the people who are listening, when you say, oh, the R's aren't quite here, they're over here, they're kind of in the middle, can you describe a little bit more about what that means? Maybe talking a bit about roticity and New York at that time, for example.
British accents are described as non-rhotic because we don't say an R after a vowel and before another consonant. So I say boardroom, and I say courthouse.
I say boardroom. Sorry to interrupt, just to compare. And courtroom. So maybe we can say those again. Can you do the first one with the B, and then I'll do it? And then you do the one with the C, and then I'll do it.
Boardroom.
Boardroom.
Courthouse.
Courthouse. Exactly, exactly. And when we say the non-rhotic version, it's because it's after a vowel. Is that correct?
I think it's, post-vocalic R. Yes, it's after a vowel, but before another consonant. So we also say like here, over there. But we will use an R if it's going into another word that starts with a vowel. And British people do this thing where we put in an R where there isn't one even in spelling, like the idea of that's amazing.
That's the intrusive R. So if there's a vowel and then an R and then a vowel, hello R, the R is there. But if there's a vowel, no R to begin with, next word starts with a vowel, up appears an R that was never there in the first place.
It's like when the word ends in a schwa vowel, like we'll only do it with if it's so. We'll say, like, for example, media attention. We hear that every day in the UK. Too much media attention.
Okay. So maybe when the next vowel is a center vowel, or maybe specifically only schwa. Well, what I'm trying to say is there's like rules and patterns, or patterns at least, that you could recognize if you're a person who knows nothing about roticity, if you're a person who knows nothing about an intrusive R, right? Or what that is. You could write these down and you could probably find examples. Okay. So just to explain a little bit for the audience, when we throw out words like this, kind of what that means. We've got R's, let's say on either side of the pond, who is more rhotic, and there's exceptions to that, tons of them. But in general, let's say New York City at that time, in the time of J. Robert Oppenheimer, during that time, were people in New York City, were they pronouncing R's already? And would somebody in the UK at that time be doing, let's say, more or less final R's?
So in the UK at that time, people were not saying final R's, for sure. And I think in New York, more people were. But Oppenheimer had this, it's called a mid-Atlantic accent or transatlantic accent.
Mm.
It was much more British influence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was actually consciously British influence. That's just how that level of educated American spoke at that time. A lot of actors spoke that way too.
Yeah, it was aspirational at the time. It was mid-Atlantic was spoken by, we can say, the upper echelon of people. So it was his personal, normal, let's say native accent at that time was to speak in a mid-Atlantic accent. You started with that. I've seen the videos of the real J. Robert Oppenheimer. I am now thinking about a mid-Atlantic accent as a starting point. Can we talk about the T's, the different varieties of T's, and then come back to how did you start with mid-Atlantic in your mind? And then how did you get Killian maybe to get to that point?
There's no great mystery to it. It's just like, hey, Killian, don't say you are. He's pretty clever. but the T thing was like brutality, mentality. It's where in a more contemporary American accent, you get mentality and brutality.
Whereas I, for example, would probably flap that T, right? And to some people, it would sound like a D, or in some languages, like more like an R. But would it be right to summarize that instead of a flapped T, you're going for more of a true T, let's say between vowels, if there's a T between vowels, perhaps, or maybe an L or an R or a W or a Y possibly in there. That was the focus to get that sound to change. Is that right?
Yep.
Awesome. So we had R's, We have T's. Is there any other specific, we can say, pronunciation or prosody aspect that you would say, here's something that you can do if you're, let's say, working towards a mid-Atlantic accent? What other features might there be that you would hone in on?
But then it was individual words, like he'd always say nuclear, process.
And this you picked up from the videos then that you watched.
It's all there.
But yeah, and you're like, oh, that's all there. You just listen and make notes, right? So I think most people might say, okay, what is it about that word? So for example, let's start with process, right? To you, why does that stick out? Why did you write that down or make a mental note of that specific word?
A process.
Even in a mid-Atlantic accent.
Yeah.
We started a mid-Atlantic accent, just to explain for the audience, you're starting at, here's a mid-Atlantic accent. In the mid-Atlantic accent, I might say, process, right? But you're saying, oh no, but wait, when I saw the videos of Oppenheimer, then I realized that he didn't say pra, he said pro, and that maybe lent a little bit of a Britishism to that, right? To summarize there. And what about the other word, the one that started with N? I don't want to say it out loud yet, because I don't want to have people hear how I say it. What about that one?
Nuclear.
Mm-hmm.
Nuclear with a y after.
I'm gonna insert that little y in there, right? Mm. So just to compare, mid-Atlantic versus this specific person who spoke in a mid-Atlantic accent at that time, you're saying there would or there would not be a little y in there.
I'm saying Oppenheimer said it.
Oh, okay. Oppenheimer said it. Okay. And in that case, do you think that was the more popular way to say it, or was that his own little idiosyncrasy?
No idea.
Okay. I'm just curious because I'm thinking back at that time, my grandmother definitely had a little a yaw insertion in there. And she would say nuclear. But I remember that the people of the next generation, like my parents, nobody would say the yuh in there, right? So I think when we think about idiolects, when we think about these things, it's a time, it's a place, it's the group of people you're surrounded by. As you said, he was an academic type, so he was speaking more like other people around him. And since that was his field, probably the majority of people around him spoke the word in the same way, even if the general population other than them didn't at the time. I find that's very niche sometimes.
He was also, his family were immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
They're Jewish immigrants. So, that had to be an influence there as well.
Exactly. And maybe this is a good time then to link. I remember reading something about Killian noticed that, and this may or may not be true, but he noticed that his children were speaking with kind of a posh accent, and he wanted to have that Irish tradition and speaking come out. So I had read, this may not be the case, that he had wanted to close that door and have more of an Irish sounding household, let's say, for that. I thought it was interesting since Killian's natural accent is Irish, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's also done like a Brummy accent as well when he was in Peaky Blinders. So here's a person, he knows how to change how he sounds. So when you say, oh, it wasn't hard for me with all of my Williams, experience to take a look at some videos, pull out some very specific things, and then transmit that to the person who needs to do it. My guess is also that, tell me if I'm wrong here, that Killian didn't need a whole lot of very specific coaching. Do you happen to remember how much work it was for you?
It was like days. We did it intensively over days. But also, I've known him 20 years. I've coached him on so many accents that there's a shortcut makes everything quicker.
Yeah. You can just tell the person, oh, remember the thing, or you might have a shortcut or something like that. A mental note. Yeah. I feel like everyone has their own process. So I know that I have my own hand signals, and I'll use little reminders. Oh, it's like the N in King, right? So I know that I have my own specific visuals and references. Can you maybe give us a few of your own little coaching nuggets about, oh, I always do this, and that always seems to work. Do you remember with anybody if you always have a certain go-to?
You'd have to ask them.
See what they remember.
Well, I find so difficult. This is so difficult to talk about dialect. You gotta,
it's just been so long. It's so automatic for you.
Probably I do.
It's funny you mentioned that because I don't notice a lot of things that I do until somebody else brings it up, perhaps, because I'm also teaching this stuff to people who don't have as much experience. I've got to, like, how should I say, do a lot of repetition, and things like that. And for example, somebody will say, oh, you just used your thinking intonation. I'm like, oh yeah, I guess I did. When I'm trying to think of, oh, what did I do yesterday? And I have that really high pitched kind of voice. I don't notice it, but they notice it. I'll curl my finger like this for an R And then I realized, like, oh, that's probably a terrible idea, since in American Sign Language, like, that's not an R, actually. That's like an X. And so I'm trying to think of, oh, maybe there's another way that I can reconcile these things, because they do become automatic after such a long time. So
oh,
I
God,
feel like
the last thing I want to do is become self-conscious about the thing. I don't know. I have no idea.
That totally makes sense. I think we've talked a lot about the idiolects in general, specifically with Oppenheimer, what you wanted to do, how you prepared for that. Luckily, we have all these videos and things online. You've been doing this for a long time, so I'm sure things with different eyes than a lot of people. Since you've been doing it for such a long time, is there something that you really love about this work? And is there something that you it just drives you crazy about it? There's nothing you can do about it, but it just drives you crazy about it.
I think my favorite part is still reading the script. Mm-hmm. And if I can hear it in my head, I get very excited about that. Uh-huh.
Oh, that's really nice.
And if I can't hear it, then I panic.
Yeah, you don't know how to do it. Yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah. What is it? And what do I hate about it? Hanging around, you know.
I could see how that would be a little bit, maybe frustrating, maybe annoying, maybe boring. But yeah, and you just never know, like, when you're going to be needed. Or is it like you have a schedule and you have to be there, but you know that you're not going to be needed? Can you plan things around that?
No, you can't plan anything. You just and it wasn't. Why do you learn a language or read a book? You go, because you're still like alert.
You're working.
But a bit, yeah.
You're like on call, basically. Yeah, that totally makes sense. If somebody wanted to become a dialect coach, is there anything that you would like to tell them about it? Anything you think they don't know that you learned along the way, and you're like, you know what? Before you get into this job, here's something you might want to think about. Is there anything like that you could tell us?
That actors are not really very interested in process. So all of this conversation would go completely over an actor's head. Anything about intervocalic R and all of that, they won't hear any of it. Just be prepared to
be very concrete, maybe very measurable in a way. Open your jaw this much, and do something that's very tangible in a way and very immediate. Like, you can immediately get the feedback of, yes, that's the right thing, rather than, let's say, the theory or the academic things behind that, because they're just not interested.
The biggest challenge to an actor, to anybody doing an accent, really, is that you think you've got to change everything. The people work too hard at changing their intonation or thinking, if I'm not singing that tune, then I'm not doing the accent. And I'd probably say 80% of my job is going, ask the question for real. Mm-hmm. Say what you mean. Mm-hmm. And then let's see what the accent does. A huge amount of the time, the accent's fine if there's the intention behind it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of you're stopping people doing things rather than that actually actively getting them to do things.
Getting them to maybe mentally put that first, and that's the guiding thing, and everything else will just fall in behind it, right? Mm. Yeah, I think especially with intonation, like you mentioned too, it's less about, let's focus on the patterns, let's analyze the patterns through some software. No, it's more like, what are you trying to do? What's your motivation? I often find the feeling also really helps. Like, what is this person feeling? Or what do they want to get the other person to feel or to do? And since we're on the subject, maybe one of the last things is, we mentioned dialect coaching, and people who are listening know that I call myself an accent coach, not a dialect coach. And what we do is similar. It overlaps a lot, but in many ways, we work with very different people. And maybe that's part of it, too. What you mentioned is the process. And often people who want just, let's say, general accent coaching, it's because they're more interested in the skill set and the transferable skills, maybe for multiple accents or in multiple sounds or things like that. So I think that for me, maybe I don't have that same concern, is that people who usually come to me for accent coaching, they are very much into the process. They want to know the reasons why, and they're looking maybe more behind it. Whereas for you, as a dialect coach, you're working with people on stage, people on screen who have a job to do, and they need to know how to do it. And I think what you mentioned is that how to do it is actually how to feel it, how to think behind it and put that first. Would you say that that's accurate?
Mm-hmm. I would say that's accurate. But I also think this whole idea of accent coaching is quite an American phenomenon. It's not really something we do in the UK. Mm-hmm. There are so many political connotations to.
Oh my God.
Because if you were going to teach an accent, what accent would you teach? Mine?
I get that. And I find myself often like a little bit conflicted too, because I feel like, you shouldn't want this, or you shouldn't have to want this. And this is often a societal pressure, or it's a marketing thing, or whatever. And so I feel very conflicted sometimes, because I'm good at this. I enjoy it. And people have this need. So I totally know where you're coming from. And there's a lot of politics that go along with it. Whereas maybe for you, that doesn't really enter into things, or very rarely.
I would avoid it. I don't do accent reduction. I don't work in that area.
I don't call it or consider it accent reduction. To me, it's everybody has an accent and they're all wonderful. And to me, it's not about reducing anything. To me, it's about acquiring something else that you think might be beneficial to you, maybe in a job interview or when you're speaking to certain people. And to me, it's more maybe akin to what you want an actor to do, is to be able to just flip the switch and put it on and take it off like a jacket. So I think that is a connotation that's out there, but it's not one that I would really also identify with either. You've been doing this for so long. You told us a little bit about how you prepare before you get on set. You said there's a lot of downtime on the set. And also, was there anything different about when you were on Oppenheimer?
Wasn't on set for Oppenheimer. So
Not at all.
You're not allowed.
Mm.
You don't have dialect coaches on Christopher Nolan's set. So this is why it's so difficult for me to talk about the project.
So in general, if you are on set, what is that like? If you were to kind of paint a picture for people who have no idea what that's like.
It does slightly depend on who you're working with and how well you know them. But most people I work with, I know pretty well. And so you turn up in the morning, and then when they're out of the makeup chair and after costume, you might go to their trailer and run the dialogue for the day and talk about that. They always say you've got 15 minutes, but you always have longer. So that's often the most useful part of the day, when you can really ask questions about the dialogue for that day. And then you just go to the set. And I personally try to say very little when someone shoots. But by then, it's got to be something quick. If there's one little thing that they've just missed or forgotten. When you've got your headphones on and you're really looking at the monitor, you go, oh, actually, that note I gave them is too big for the shot. Mm-hmm. So often I'm doing things I've done.
Mm-hmm. So then before that, so you're on set, everything should be good to go. Maybe they're just, what, reminders or cues or something like that for the day's script. So to get to that point, what do you do to prepare with an actor? Is it mostly a Zoom call? Is it something that you meet in person to do? What do you find is most effective?
It's all effective. It depends where they are. I don't think there is one way that's more effective than the other.
Maybe the tools that you're using, it just depends on what's available. Like, how would you describe your style?
Mm-hmm. Take my lead from the actor, because some actors really like to drill the dialogue and some like to just read stage directions or poems that are reminiscent in some way of the scripts. It sort of depends on where they want to start. But whatever they're doing, I do bespoke drills. So if I can hear there's a particular vowel, I'll make something up that's sort of in the style of the text that will help them. And then sometimes I might go through the whole script and find every word that has that vowel. So they're drilling a list of words for that vowel rather than just drill the dialogue over and over again. It's a reactive job. It's a relationship-based job. Actors all have different styles, so it depends what their style is. I don't think it's a good idea to have a particular style.
Oh my God, I love that. It's very, like you said, it's bespoke. It's specifically about the person, and it's more about what works for them. And the better you know them, you already have all these tools in your tool bag. You say, okay, this isn't working for you today, or this is not really for you. Then you can reach into your bag of tricks and be like, okay, so I'll make a list then. Here's the target word. I'll make a list of other words that are maybe kind of similar, or they have the same links or the same gliding, whatever that is. And again, you, with your expert eyes, you can see exactly what the problem is. You can take that person that you know and find the solution that works the best for that day in that case.
But I am essentially making it up. That's why it's really hard for me to talk about what's my style.
If you didn't, that would be probably a boring experience. Probably wouldn't work as well, right? If you said, this is how I work and this, we have to follow this pattern, because I know there's a lot of people out there who teach in that way. I think what you're describing now is probably why you're so good at that, is because you don't have one specific way to do it, one specific thing that other people need to follow. You just instinctively know after all these years. Do you know what I mean?
Hope so.
Yes, it's clear. It's clear from all the work that you've done. I want to thank you so much, William, for talking today about your work in general, about accent coaching versus dialect coaching. general accents versus idiolects, and specifically working with Cillian Murphy on Oppenheimer. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Very well.
Awesome, awesome. Thanks so much. See you soon.
Bye.
My favorite takeaway from today's talk is how we all get so good at our jobs. It's almost difficult to describe how we do it after a while. And the more we know someone, the easier it is to help them. I hope you enjoyed today's episode as much as I did. If you found this episode helpful in any way, please subscribe and leave a review. It's actually really helpful to me. Now, before I go, I have two tasks for you to do. First, I want you to register and come to my free monthly masterclass. They're on the last Thursday of the month. In just 1 hour, you're going to master a specific American accent skill. For example, the TH sound or rhythm. The Zoom registration link actually changes each month. So the second and maybe more important thing I want to ask you to do is to sign up for my mailing list, because you're going to get the registration link each month and you're going to get bonus materials before and after the masterclass that I only send to my email list subscribers. The email opt-in link is down in the show notes. Be sure to sign up for my mailing list and come to the monthly masterclass for free. I'm Bianca, your personal American accent coach, and I want you to know that your voice is your choice. Thanks for sticking around to the end of the show. I'll see you in the next episode. Bye for now.